Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, January 12, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. In case you missed it, let me inform you that the world changed this last week in ways that were both visible and unmistakable. First and most visible was the dramatic shift in the U.S. presidential campaign with the results in the New Hampshire primary last Tuesday. Though the polls showed that Barack Obama was ahead anywhere from 7 to 12%, and some of the pundits were saying that it could be larger, and some were even predicting the end for Hillary Clinton, when the voters spoke, they gave Hillary Clinton a decisive victory. Secondly, was the push for an independent presidential bid by billionaire and fascist New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. This was given a boost by 17 mostly former elected officials, some has-beens and never-was, in a so-called bipartisan forum in Norman, Oklahoma. And also unfolding this week was the open push for deadly budget cuts by California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Arnie, who refers to Bloomberg as his soulmate, virtually acknowledged in his speech to the legislature on Thursday that he knows that these cuts will kill people, but he said that fiscal responsibility, which is his name for killer cuts, is a virtue. So during the first full week of 2008, we've seen exactly what Lyndon LaRouche has been forecasting since he said in his July 25th, 2007 webcast that the financial system has already collapsed, that there will be a coordinated effort by the City of London to impose Mussolini-style fascist policies, corporatist policies, with Bloomberg chosen to play the role of Mussolini, and that at the same time there's a potential for a Franklin Roosevelt reflex, a return to the anti-depression policies of the American system. The victory by Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire was based on her emphasis on economic issues, particularly action to stop foreclosures, and reflects the growing support nationally for Lyndon LaRouche's Homeowner and Bank Protection Act. So joining us today to discuss these dramatic developments will be Deborah Freeman, the national spokesman for Lyndon LaRouche. Also, we'll hear from Megan Roulard from the LaRouche Youth Movement, who was in New Hampshire in the 2 weeks leading up to the election, and Michael Steger, who recently returned to Los Angeles from several months in Washington, D.C. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Harley. It's good to be here.
Now, clearly, as Lyndon LaRouche said, a change occurred in New Hampshire. So what happened?
Well, you know, in the aftermath of the Iowa loss, a number of events were set into motion. And they were ironic at first because Hillary's loss in Iowa didn't come as a particular surprise to anyone. She never expected to win there. And in fact, she came out of the Iowa caucuses with only one delegate less than Barack Obama, which really, by some people's estimate, would have been, you know, looked at as a draw. But in fact, what the response in the media was that Hillary had suffered a stunning defeat. And even before the candidates boarded their planes for New Hampshire, an extraordinarily vicious media campaign was unleashed, declaring virtually the end of the campaign.
Right.
Poll numbers were coming out showing an incredible surge by Obama. And, you know, Hillary's campaign, like all of these presidential campaigns, have pollsters of their own. And their polls were not showing that at all. What their polls were showing was that, in fact, in the aftermath of Iowa, as one would expect, Obama experienced a surge of a couple of percentage points in New Hampshire, but she still had a comfortable lead. But nevertheless, the press barrage was relentless. And rumors were circulated that she was out of the campaign, that she was about to withdraw. And as this process continued, what her pollsters began to report was that, in fact, the panic that this disinformation campaign intended was in fact taking hold. And the faked results themselves began to cause panic. Her numbers did then start to fall. And
so there actually was then a shift as a result of this initial media operation.
Absolutely. Her numbers began to fall. And in addition to her numbers falling, an increasing number of voters were indicating that since the outcome of the election was already established, that they probably wouldn't make the trip to the polls. Now, the one thing that, you know, that operates here is that the Clintons have been the object of British orchestrated media campaigns before. And that was actually helpful in this particular instance, because we and others were really trying to get a message through that these people were not particularly interested in Barack Obama, but that they were going with Obama today, but that just as they were anointing him today, they would dump him tomorrow, and that what this really was about was paving the way for a Bloomberg independent candidacy. What happened as they watched her numbers fall was that I think on Sunday, Bill and Hillary Clinton, Chelsea Clinton, and a couple of very close longtime friends and advisors met. And the Hillary Clinton that came out of that meeting was a different person than the Hillary Clinton that went in. She abandoned the campaign persona that had been scripted for her, and she went with her instinct and reached out to the lower 80%. This is exactly what LaRouche has been insisting from the beginning that any serious presidential candidate had to do. And it was precisely what we had been doing all over the country, and most specifically since Christmas, in the state of New Hampshire. And it was interesting because the Clinton campaign began not only to address what we refer to as the lower 80%, but they also made a decision that it was time to appeal to what they refer to as the millennials or the Generation Y voters. And they launched a very effective campaign with a series of roundtables and other things among younger voters. They also revamped their website to launch an Ask Hillary feature, which encouraged young voters to pose questions directly to the candidate. But at the heart of all of it really was the fact that Hillary was the only candidate who was prepared to speak directly on the foreclosure crisis.
So it wasn't then just that there was a change in the persona, but it actually was a change in what was being presented, the content.
Yes. It was a real change and a very fundamental one because, you know, as the first woman running for president, and also just because of her own psychological makeup, Hillary was very susceptible to the idea that she was a woman running, but she had to run as the anti-woman, which meant that she had to steer away from domestic issues, concentrate on the international issues, on competence, and to show that she had no emotion, that she would not react emotionally in any situation. And it was a setup. But finally, in the face of what really was a crisis in the campaign, with help from her closest, the people closest to her, she emerged, she took charge of her own campaign, and she addressed what she knew were the vital issues facing the nation. With certainly the question of the mortgage crisis being the heart of it. But, you know, before this had all occurred, she already was the first candidate who had put forward any kind of comprehensive policy on the question of the mortgage crisis. But
she had already endorsed a 90-day moratorium, I believe, on foreclosures.
Well, actually, yeah, she had endorsed a 90-day moratorium with the potential for a three-year moratorium on foreclosures. But it was not front and center in what she was doing. But after this meeting, it became the center of what they were doing. It was noted with a response that Bill Clinton gave on Monday night in response to a question about the subprime mortgage issue, where he not only gave a fairly elaborate presentation of the history of the crisis, but he went after the hedge funds. And she just continued to hammer away at these central points. And the fact is, when she said on election night that in listening to the people of New Hampshire, she found her own voice, I think it may have been one of the most honest statements that she has made during the course of the campaign.
When I saw that, it really hit me, because I had just seen Obama with his usual inspirational, contentless speech, and I was thinking, well, what is Hillary going to say to top that? And just the simple statement, "I listened to you and I found my voice," I thought was quite an eloquent indication that there was something different.
Well, you know, Harley, I've been in Washington for a long time, and a lot of that time was spent working as Lynn's liaison to the Clinton administration during the 8 years of Bill Clinton's presidency. And it has also consisted of work on Capitol Hill, where of course Hillary represents the state of New York as the junior senator from New York. And I will say this, the Hillary Clinton who spoke that Tuesday night after the New Hampshire victory was a much more reasonable representation of the real Hillary Clinton. And it was extremely important for her to drop the campaign persona and to actually take up these issues. And, you know, the results in New Hampshire were startling. She won 47% of the vote to Obama's 32%. Among those with incomes under $50,000 a year, among young people between the ages of 25 and 29, she won a clear majority of the votes. But you know, more importantly than the dynamic of New Hampshire itself or of Hillary's campaign per se, the fact of the matter was that by doing what she did, it forced the issue. And right now, two things occurred. One is that if they thought they had a cakewalk to dictatorship with this Bloomberg candidacy, that just went out the window. Number two, they got the exact opposite result that they intended, which is that now every other candidate is forced to respond to the issues that Hillary has defined. And every indication is that she is not stopping with New Hampshire. Yesterday, very interestingly, she became the first presidential candidate to acknowledge the fact that the nation was in the midst of a deep economic crisis. And she issued a call for Congress to act now. She made clear that this could not wait until the presidential campaign or anything else. She asked for $30 billion to be allocated in an emergency housing crisis fund, for another $25 billion in emergency energy assistance to help families who are facing skyrocketing heating bills, $5 billion to aid those seeking to make their homes more energy efficient, and $10 billion to extend and broaden unemployment insurance. And then she then added that the depth of the crisis is such that this $70 billion may not be sufficient, and that as such, Congress must stand ready to issue an additional $40 billion rebate to working families, if in fact this is not sufficient. Now, it falls far short of what Lynn has enunciated. But the fact of the matter is that it sets the tone, and I think above all else, it really does represent a very, very loud, aggressive, and unmistakable shot fired across the bow of her enemies. It's a real shift in the dynamics of approach, and I think that it pulls the entire nation back from the brink.
You're listening to Deborah Freeman, the spokesman for Lyndon LaRouche, the national spokesman who's with us today on the LaRouche Show. I think also, Debbie, that it stands in sharp contrast to what you see from Bloomberg and Bloomberg's buddy Arnold Schwarzenegger, who this week was very prominent out here on the West Coast in announcing that he's prepared to kill people to cut the budget.
Kind of like the difference between FDR and Adolf Hitler.
Well, and that's why I think that this idea of the visible shift, the other thing that really occurred this week is that with Bank of America announcing it's buying Countrywide, with the continuing horrendous figures of on the economy, the housing sales, the terrible Christmas sales, and then on top of that, the report we got today that there are as many as $3 trillion in write-downs in the banking system. I mean, certainly it would seem that someone would have to address it. Is your sense that this is going to be the continuing theme now of the Clinton campaign?
Well, I think that the fact now is that Hillary Clinton she's gotten a certain whiff of what the potential is. And she also now sees that in educating the population on this question, that they do actually respond, that they are capable of being mobilized. But the fact is that thus far, she has not gone far enough. And, you know, I think, you know, and people can argue that I'm biased, but the fact of the matter is that the only way that anybody is going to see their way through this crisis is by embracing the policies that Lynn has put on the table. He's repeatedly warned that we would find ourselves at this point. The fact is we are now at this point, and he stands alone as someone who has prepared for precisely this crisis. While everyone else was denying that it would ever happen, LaRouche was putting together the kind of package that would allow us safe passage through the crisis. And,
well,
and I think it really does come down to that.
Yeah, and let me take up a specific question then. As you mentioned this, I've noticed a shift as well on this question of free trade, the openness to discuss some of the questions of trade pacts, of minimal standards of protection for labor, you know, not just minimum wage, but creation of jobs. This is something she mentioned yesterday in her speech out in Los Angeles. She used the term, we need to create jobs that can't be outsourced.
Right.
So I think this fits in with what you're saying.
But I think really, and you know, this is kind of the rub in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what we have to understand is that there were two things that created this. Well, probably more than two things, but essentially, what created this shift in the Clinton campaign was the force of reality in the economic crisis, the ferocity of the enemy attack against her, and it took her a while to figure out exactly who and what that enemy was. And then, of course, the work that we did on the ground, not only in New Hampshire, but all over the country, in creating a mass effect around these very questions. Now, the question of what happens next, I think, really has more to do with whether or not we can continue to organize and whether or not we can continue a relentless mobilization to educate people as to the reality of the meltdown, and to educate people as to the viable and available solutions. If we can do that, given this shift in dynamic that we see coming out of the Clinton campaign, then I think we've got a hopeful situation, not a guaranteed situation, but certainly a hopeful situation. And I know that Lynn is prepared to do his job in all of this, and I know that certainly the members of the LaRouche Youth Movement are more than prepared to do their job. I don't think anything is going to stop them from doing it. And I think really that's where the really critical question lies as to whether or not we have the resources to continue and to escalate what we've already set into motion.
Well, we'll be hearing in just a moment from a couple members of the LaRouche Youth Movement. I do want to emphasize, and I'll say this now and we'll bring it up again several times, that on January 17th, Lyndon LaRouche will be giving another webcast. This one 2 days after the House of Representatives returns, a few days before the Senate returns, but on January 17th, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, it will be Lyndon LaRouche addressing the nation and the world on precisely these issues. Now, also, I think, as you mentioned, the mobilization of the LaRouche Youth Movement and forces associated with Lynn in particular, we had new developments the last couple of days in with the opening of state legislatures, Rhode Island, Missouri, and Maryland.
Yes.
In each of those three states, there's been the introduction of a resolution in support of LaRouche's Homeowner and Bank Protection Act. Some people wonder, I hear this all the time, well, if there's something done on a state level or if a city council passes a resolution, does that get up to the Congress? Do the presidential candidates know about it? What about that, Debbie?
Absolutely, yes. And what you have to keep in mind is that at the same time that we're mobilizing the base of these congressional representatives and presidential candidates, we are also very visible and very present in Washington, where it's simply fear and denial by at least some people that is stopping them from just endorsing Lynn's policy. Each and every time a state legislature, each and every time a city council or a county council passes a resolution in support of the HBPA, it brings us that much closer to forcing the issue with the U.S. Congress. And I think that I think that Hillary's recent move does that as well, because it is the first time that somebody has stepped forward and has spoken in recognition of the crisis. And also, if you look at the features of what she's calling for, she's making clear that this is not just a peculiar subprime mortgage crisis, but that this is an across-the-board economic crisis. But I can assure people that there is no body anywhere in the United States that is too small to have an effect on the overall mood on Capitol Hill at this time. And, you know, these guys are not going to move unless they are forced. And this is precisely the kind of action that does force them. And, I think that the kind of dynamic that we've been able to unleash in the state of Pennsylvania, where you have scores and scores of elected bodies considering and passing the HBPA, is something that we want to create in states all across the nation. I would also point out that what you do have also going on, I think largely catalyzed by what we've done with the HBPA, is you have a variety of other proposals being introduced and other actions being introduced. In Baltimore, Maryland, I know the mayor has filed a lawsuit against Wells Fargo for their reprehensible loan practices. In New York State, a piece of legislation is coming on board that echoes the kind of action that FDR took to renegotiate some of the more predatory loans. It's a dynamic that has taken on a life of its own. The problem is that without a clear understanding of economics, people do things with the best intention, but without actually establishing a firewall to protect the banking system and critical financial institutions, you're not going to succeed in dealing with this. And as far as I know, and I think I have a pretty good picture of where things stand nationally, there is nothing on the table except the HBPA that does address this question of establishing a firewall to protect these fundamental institutions.
Well, let me amplify that point for our listeners, that you just heard from the the most astute observer of politics inside Washington.
Oh, thank you.
The Congress and the presidential campaigns are well aware of this motion. So those of you who are out there who have not yet moved on this, whether it's to just print off a copy of the HBPA from the LaRouche PAC website, take it to your city council, take it to your state representative, to your labor union, to your civic group, and get motion on it. And while you're doing that, write a check to LaRouche PAC so that we can get this, even amplify it further. Now, before I bring on the two members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, I have just one more question for you, Debbie, and then I want you to stick around because we'll want to include you in the roundtable discussion we have at the end of the program. But on this Bloomberg campaign, clearly it's more visible that this is in fact a campaign. There have been some developments in the last couple of days. How seriously are people in Washington and in the political establishment, how seriously are they taking it now?
They're taking it very seriously because, and, you know, some of the people who I talk to, I was surprised to hear say that if Obama were to somehow get the Democratic nomination, that they would support Bloomberg. Now, that's without really understanding who Bloomberg is. But the fact of the matter is this is taken very seriously. What you have here is you have a you have an individual with the capability to finance an independent campaign. And, you know, it's echoes of Ross Perot for some people, but even that view is a very unsophisticated view. Mm-hmm. If Bloomberg enters this race, he doesn't enter it as a spoiler. Bloomberg enters the race to move forward with a, you know, with a hardcore fascist program. And there is no understanding of that except for what we are currently putting out. And the population, ironically, seems to have a better sense of it than some of the people in Washington. I know that when some of our organizers went out with banners that said things like, you know, if you like Dick Cheney, you'll love Michael Bloomberg, or don't let billionaire Bloomberg buy the presidency. They got a very, very quick response because it's, in a sense, it's an American reflex. The American people do not like the idea of a billionaire, you know, popping onto the scene, buying the presidency. But they don't understand yet what really is going on. And our job is to make them understand it.
Well, what's behind it besides the ego of Michael Bloomberg?
What's behind it is the same thing that's behind Arnie Schwarzenegger. The fact is that we are facing a global financial breakdown. And the normal impulse of the United States, the Roosevelt impulse, the impulse to protect the general welfare, is something that the British, Dutch financial oligarchy really just cannot tolerate in a period like this. They must control the U.S. presidency. And the idea of a Clinton presidency, a Hillary Clinton in the White House with, you know, with her husband in the bedroom, is they went down that road once before. There's hysteria about Clinton's old call for a new financial architecture. There is hysteria about Lyndon LaRouche's relationship with Clinton. And I'll tell you, sometimes I think these guys far overestimate the connection. Lynn does not whisper in Bill Clinton's ear every night. I don't think Hillary whispers there either. But it's a very clear drive. And if you look at the people behind it, there's no question that it is the same apparatus, the Schultz crowd and the Republican Party and the ugly face of Felix Rohatyn on the Democratic side. And that's what this is all about. And Rohatyn, you know, has done his job in wrecking the Democratic Party and creating a circumstance where somebody like Bloomberg would have even a hope of getting close to the presidency. If Democrats were acting like Democrats, as they did under Mr. LaRouche's direction during the fight to save Social Security, this guy wouldn't have he wouldn't have a snowball's chance in hell. But
I would add to that that the effect of the LaRouche Youth Movement following the Social Security fight carried over into November 2005 when Schwarzenegger was trying to establish dictatorial powers, and he lost all four of his referenda. So the question of being able to mobilize to defeat this is a life and death issue for the country. I would encourage people to pick up the next issue of the Executive Intelligence Review, which will be covering in depth the Schwarzenegger, Bloomberg, Mussolini option, including direct quotes where you see Schwarzenegger and Bloomberg's discussion of bipartisan, nonpartisan, postpartisan is really just a rechanneling of the 1920s and 30s fascist movement.
Well, you got to look at that up close, Harley. You were there in Oklahoma. Do those guys look like a nonpartisan American patriotic movement to you?
To tell you the truth, it looked to me like a bunch of Jeremy Benthams who were stuffed and rolled out into a room, and Michael Bloomberg looked very short. And he didn't say a whole lot. And obviously what was going on is a behind-the-scenes discussion. And again, this is available in the report I filed in the current or upcoming issue of the EIR. Let me turn to Megan Roulard, who is joining us today. Megan had a chance to organize in New Hampshire, was involved in some very significant exchanges on policy with various candidates. Megan, why don't you give us a report from New Hampshire?
Sure. I'd start by saying the work that we did in New Hampshire, the idea was initially by no means to really track or follow any of the candidates who were up there. It was simply a continuation of our mobilization from here in Boston around LaRouche's Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. And we have extended ourselves into the states of Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire as well. So, you know, we figure there's a politicized environment up there, and we should go organize these people with LaRouche's literature and policies. So we were up there we probably attended and organized people at about 20 of the Democratic candidates' events up there with the intention of shaping the mind of the election process. Now, the first thing that we realized was that nobody else was doing that. None of the campaigns actually had any literature at all for the voters.
Isn't that, Debbie, is that unusual? Don't these campaigns usually have brochures or something?
Yes.
Yeah,
there's not a lack of money.
Do. No, they usually do, but there have been a few articles about this in places like Congressional Quarterly. They say that the new campaign geometry is that you conduct your campaign on the internet and on the airwaves, and that the old handouts are a thing of the past. So I think it's a combination of that and the fact that some of them just don't have a hell of a lot to say.
Right. Yeah.
So, Megan, we were out there then with the various pamphlets that the LaRouche PAC has put out recently then.
Right. And the population of New Hampshire is very interesting because there is a real familiarity with LaRouche as a presidential candidate and with his ideas, except this is the first, this is really the first year where he is not running for president. But when we told the people there that, look, LaRouche has crucial economic policy advice for the next president of the United States, whoever it may be, people were grabbing this stuff up. And, at some of the events of candidates like Edwards and Obama, there was a little bit more to joke about because there was really zero substance at all when it came to a discussion of economic policy. So that was a large part of what we were able to do, and the electorate, very much appreciated it. And one thing I would just add is there were what I thought were, some useful exchanges with Hillary Clinton. We attended a lot of her events, and I just give an example of one of the first events that we attended up there in Manchester. Now, this is before the shift that LaRouche has noted in the Clinton campaign in the days before the primary. And it was an event for women and their daughters. You were only supposed to ask questions, you know, about women's issues and this type of thing. And it was a relatively large audience, and I was able to really ask the first question that had anything to do with economic policy, and just brought up the fact that, you know, that it was very very good that she had come out with a plan to halt foreclosures, which she hadn't spoken about during the event itself. And one thing I noticed was that the people in there, you know, when I was asking this question, everybody turned around. A lot of people were, you know, nodding their heads. And I said, look, this is very good that you've called for this, but what are you going to do about the much larger banking crisis and the fact that banks are actually, we actually have banks that are insolvent? And she was, you know, she was very eager to respond and gave a very, actually gave a very long answer, one of the longest answers that she gave during the event, and not only outlined her her call for a moratorium on foreclosures, but also did make clear, she said that there are banks, she said Wall Street is not happy about my policy, and she said there are banks in Shanghai and Abu Dhabi who have securities that are based on these mortgages, and that these interests cannot come first. And, you know, the exchange in and of itself is important, but also after the event, I had a couple people who were there come up to me afterwards and just thank me for asking the question.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in the days that followed, there was another event several days later with Bill Clinton. This is actually before what was initially referenced, where he had a you know, relatively in-depth discussion of the subprime mortgage crisis. This also happened a couple days prior in Rochester, where he was asked about this. We were preparing to ask him a question, and then somebody in the audience asked him about this. He gave a very long answer, and the next woman who asked him a question was an extremely elderly, sick woman who got into the auditorium and basically said, you know, Mike, I don't really have a question for you. I'm just letting you know that in a couple of weeks, I basically am going to have to live on $300 a month, and, you know, how am I going to survive? And he was visibly, you know, he was visibly shocked by that, I think, and moved. So, these are just a couple of the things that we sort of noticed in the days even prior to the shift that occurred the beginning of this week.
Debbie, from your past experience with the Clinton administration, the administration of Bill Clinton, and the work you've done, it's clear that in Hillary's campaign the last few days, the idea of the speaking for the invisible Americans is a real echo of Franklin Roosevelt's Forgotten Man.
Absolutely.
To what extent do you think that Bill and Hillary Clinton and the people around them are looking at this FDR precedent?
It's very conscious, especially on Bill's part. I mean, you have to keep in mind that in Bill Clinton, what you're dealing with is somebody who, above everything else, is a student of history and a true intellectual. And he is well aware of the fact that the magnitude of this crisis far surpasses the crisis that we faced in the 30s, in the 30s coming into the Second World War. That is something which is very much on their minds, and we know for a fact that many of the people in the campaign are looking very closely, in addition to looking at Lynn's work, they are looking, and they continue to look, at many of the relief packages that were put together by FDR. Also keep in mind that in the person of Bill Clinton, both during his presidency, but also very significantly since his presidency, he also has a certain global picture. He has spent an extraordinary amount of time in Africa and in Asia, and he's well aware of the depth of the catastrophe in those places, but he also knows there's no solution to it in those places, that the solution can only come inside the United States. So I think that also has a very big impact. But the reference to the invisible men and women was by no means an accident. Mm-hmm. And it was an intentional hearkening back to FDR. And remember, in the aftermath of the 2006 presidential campaign, the 2004 presidential campaign, before Roe Hatton reared his ugly head, one of the things that came out of the Kerry campaign, which at least looked like the one saving grace, was that coming out of the Kerry campaign in the mobilization around Social Security, it looked like at least the debate around FDR inside the Democratic Party had been won by Mr. LaRouche, and that there was a reassertion of the Democrats as the party of Roosevelt. There was a very strong backlash against that, particularly as we mobilized for the saving of the auto industry. And Roe Hatton and Wall Street and the bankers really made their presence felt. Obviously, the auto industry suffered, and the nation suffered, because not only did we lose a critical, really critical feature of our segment of our machine tool industry, but we also got two full-blown fascists on the Supreme Court as a result.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to apologize to our listeners, because I will not be able to take emails because my computer is not functioning properly right now. It could be a product of my technical expertise, but it may be another glitch in the system. But I'd like to, speaking of the FDR versus Mussolini Hitler, Michael Stager is with us in Los Angeles. Michael's a veteran of campaigns going back now 5 years, where the LaRouche Youth Movement has been the only consistent force that's been in the street prodding and smacking the Democratic Party to come out against Arnie in a consistent way. Schwarzenegger this week announced that he's going to deal with a $3 billion deficit for the next 6 months, and then $14.5 billion and growing deficit for next year by cutting aid to the poor, the elderly, the blind, the disabled, slashing $4 billion from education. And, of course, Arnie, as we've pointed out, is a bad actor who was brought in by Schultz, George Schultz, and the same Felix Rohatyn that Deborah's been talking about, who's the wrecker of the Democratic Party. So, Michael, give us a sense. We're going out against supposedly the popular actor. What do we find when we go out and make these comparisons of Schwarzenegger and Bloomberg to Mussolini?
Yeah, thanks, Harley. The general response is yesterday we were organizing in Los Angeles, and the polemic we were leading with was, hey, do you want to help us take the batteries out of Arnie? A common one that goes back to 2003, when the LaRouche Youth Movement here in California kind of initiated its mobilization statewide against Schwarzenegger's total recall. And he really is the fascist son Joe Kennedy always wanted. And that's the response. People recognize his draconian austerity is modeled on Hitler and Mussolini. And as you put yesterday, you know, it really is. He thinks of himself as a Hitler, but really he's just more of a Mussolini. He's kind of an overgrown meathead who they had recognized he had the stomach to do what was necessary. And that's why he got the job.
He's getting a bigger stomach these days, too, because I don't think he's taking
Yes, all those Krispy Kreme donuts I hear. So,
Krispy Kreme.
Anyway, some people think it's a small African children, but we account that for Al Gore.
but you're going out, and people are aware that he came out with this slashing of the budget, huh?
Yeah, people know it. And people generally recognize that the Democratic Party in California, really since he made his kind of about-face, instead of calling the Democratic Party wimps and attacking the firefighters, nurses, and teachers as special interests, after his referendum were defeated in 2005, he switched in 2006 to be so-called this post-partisan collaborator with the Democratic Party environmentalist. And now the Democratic Party is stuck here in California, led by people like Pelosi and Feinstein on the national level, where they've capitulated to this type of leadership. And so now what we're facing is Schwarzenegger going for complete austerity against the lower 80% of California citizens, and they know it. What they want to see is people taking leadership on recognizing what the real problem is, and that's what we're doing out in the streets.
And people are aware that there are Bushvilles springing up in California.
That's right. There's a Bushville down in Ontario, California, near Orange County. And the economic crisis out here is severe, a $14 billion deficit. I've heard this is half of the total state deficits across the country. So it's very real. I think statistics like, 20% of the new jobs over the last 5 years come in real estate areas of home construction, mortgage lending. These people are all out of work. You go to organize in Orange County or in Los Angeles, even in affluent areas, people are telling you, I'm out of work. I was in construction. I was in real estate. I was in finance. I was in mortgage. I'm facing foreclosure. I can't pay my rent. I can't pay this. And it's generally hitting a large portion of the population. It's very real for people out here. And Schwarzenegger's policies are killing people. They have over the last 4 or 5 years, or the last 3 years. One of the first things he did was cut a state program for children's health care. So his mentality is really to, as he said, fiscal responsibility, like compassion, is a virtue. So he really sees that it's his job, that if he has to kill people, that he's the guy to do it. And that's what we're going after.
And, Debbie, talk about the question of the Schwarzenegger-Bloomberg relationship. I mean, by hitting Arnie out here, we're preempting the Bloomberg campaign, aren't we?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that, I think Arnie Schwarzenegger was really the test run for a Bloomberg-style candidacy. He's just a lot bigger.
Arnie's not quite as tall as he looks. I think both of them have these lifts that they wear.
He's a lot taller than Michael Bloomberg, Harley.
that's true. Susan Eisenhower is a lot taller than Michael Bloomberg.
Yes, but I'm a lot taller than all of them. So.
Now, Megan, we got the, as I understand it, this last week, besides Rhode Island, there's now motion in New Hampshire for the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act.
Yeah, and this was interesting. It was actually at a Bill Clinton event in New Hampshire that we met a very feisty New Hampshire state representative who the two representatives who, there is a bill in the New Hampshire State House which is going to be voted on and discussed during this month. And then at one of these events just this past week, we didn't know either of the women who had sponsored this. We met a very feisty representative who wants to be an ally of ours and wants us to go up there and organize. We also have a vote coming up early next week in the Rhode Island State House, and we're now getting motion in the Massachusetts State House, which is very important because the Democratic Party in Boston and Massachusetts has had a very severe Felix Rowetton problem in the recent period. But the work that we've done in the city councils, for example, has now allowed us to get things moving there.
Well, it's not at all surprising that in two of the bluest states in the country, Massachusetts and California, you have Rowetton deployed to wreck the Democratic Party. Debbie, what can you tell us about this Rowetton-Schultz collaboration over the years?
Well, this goes back, as I said, to the aftermath of the Social Security fight, when it was clear that we were faced with the potential loss of the auto industry and most importantly of the machine tool sector as tied to that industry. We were involved in a massive drive nationally and a massive drive on Capitol Hill, and we were getting a very good response. And then suddenly, there was an intervention by Nancy Pelosi at the behest of Felix Rohatyn. And in fact, that support for the LaRouche proposal began to wane. Right around that time, I happened to find myself as a guest at a Washington, D.C. reception. And one of the other guests was none other than Felix Rohatyn. And over drinks, we were chatting. And he was not too pleased to kind of be my captive there for a while. But but he really didn't have too much of a choice because, as I said...
Well, you're used to that.
Yeah, and I'm a lot taller than all of them, so it works out okay. But one of the things that we were chatting about was Franklin Delano Roosevelt and what FDR would have done if faced with a similar crisis. And Rohatyn got extremely exasperated and responded that, you know, FDR was fine for then, but that was then and this is now. And the situation now is that you have private financial institutions whose annual budget far outweighs that of so-called, and that so-called was his term, not mine, sovereign nations. And that, therefore, why should these nations have more of a say than these financial institutions?
And so it's explicit then.
Absolutely explicit.
Yeah.
I was, you know, it was one of those instances where I was shocked but not surprised. We knew that this was his position, but I never expected him to come out and say it publicly and to say it in front of other people. But he was emphatic about it, and he fought for that position.
And this is a continuing thing with him. Didn't Pelosi just invite him to present to the Democratic Party why they should go along with Bush's so-called foreclosure bill instead of what LaRouche is saying and what the Clinton campaign is moving towards?
Well, she invited him to a quote-unquote leadership meeting where this was adopted. However, this so-called leadership meeting, just to give you an example of how Pelosi does business, did not include Congressman Charles Rangel of New York, who happens to be the chairman of Ways and Means. Now, that is without question the single most powerful committee in the House of Representatives, and nobody has a discussion of a leadership issue, especially a leadership issue on an economic question, without the involvement of the chairman of Ways and Means. But Pelosi knew that there was no way that Charlie Rangel would go along with it, so she conveniently forgot to invite him. And it gives you, you know, the question of Nancy Pelosi is, I mean, it's not the subject of our show, but I mean, this, you know, this woman, in her absolute stupidity and incompetence, has done more damage to the Democratic Party than that imbecile Bush, you know, could do in his wildest dreams. She has been a one-woman wrecking operation, and she has left the party extremely demoralized. She's come very close to breaking the spirit of the congressional freshman. I think the only thing that really stops that is our continued fight and our continued presence. But this woman is an absolute disaster, and she's the lapdog of Felix Rohatyn, because she has no thoughts of her own. So whatever he tells her to do is what she does, and hopes that the money comes in as a result.
Now, I just want to return to Michael for a moment. I know there's some plans mapped out for this next couple of weeks. You've got the California primary February 5th. But what I understand is that there's a plan for a major recruitment push as the campus is open around the HBPA. Do you want to say something about that, Michael?
Yeah, I'd love to. This political situation is optimal for what we're doing politically out here in California. since our intervention in 2003 on Schwarzenegger, then in 2005 with his referendum, and now his budget policies. In the context of a presidential election year and a LaRouche PAC pamphlet, The Devil on Your Laptop, we have an opportunity to really provoke a lot of young people to think about, one, the cultural impact that the current youth culture has today on the minds of young people and their sense of society, their sense of history, and also a very, very realistic picture that the situation in our society today is completely severe. I mean, it's absolutely extreme. I think a lot of young people realize it, and so I think the opportunity to recruit out of this environment is going to be it's going to be awesome.
And Debbie, I'd like to, we have about 5 minutes left, I'd like to come back to the importance of the webcast that's going to take place this coming Thursday, January 17th, 1 p.m. Eastern. If you can't be on it at 1 p.m. Eastern, it will be archived, but you've been presiding over these for since this has become an institution in Washington. What effect, how does this webcast function in terms of the effect, both the build-up for it and then after Lynn has spoken?
Well, you know, I think that repeatedly we've seen dramatic developments after each and every one of Lynn's webcasts over the course of the last 4 years. But in this particular instance, both because of the depth of the crisis and because of this stunning shift in the presidential campaign, there is no question that all eyes are on this press conference, at least all eyes in Washington, are on this webcast on Thursday. And I would also add that because so many of the policymakers in Washington are reluctant to sit down with Lynn one-on-one for any variety of different reasons, it is also these webcasts that have become the major forum for direct dialogue between Lynn and these policymakers. And we have never had a situation like we have now where a full week prior to the webcast, before Lynn has even opened up his mouth, questions are pouring in.
You've been deluged recently. I see you up there shuffling paper like crazy.
It is just nonstop. And I think this is going to be a truly historic event. I would encourage people to do whatever they have to do, not only to listen to it themselves, but to build audiences for it and to alert their friends, their family, and policymakers in their local area. I think that what's discussed this Thursday is going to be indispensable in the fight for survival for our nation.
And Megan, I assume we're going to have a showing of this up in Boston?
Yes, in Boston and, I believe, in Rhode Island.
Good.
Okay, and Michael, I know we'll hit every place we can in greater L.A. with the leaflet announcing it.
Most definitely.
And if Harley can get his computer working, he can watch it too.
I have many computers here. I'll find one to get to my many correspondents via email to make sure they're on it. And Debbie, just to conclude, we've seen, as we've been discussing for the last hour, an incredible shift this week. There's no reason to believe that you can put the genie back in the bottle now.
Absolutely not. But the way to guarantee that is for us to continue the mobilization that we've unleashed and to make sure that the events leading up to the webcast on Thursday actually up the ante and result in bringing the HBPA legislation to Congress as what really is just the first step toward national recovery. I've never been more confident that we can do it than I am at this moment, but it's going to take a huge effort, and it's going to take more money than we have now. So I would really urge anyone who's listening today. I know people have given generously, but it's the beginning of the year. Very few of our supporters have reached their limit, and I know people tend to think in terms of budgeting a certain amount of money per week or per month to give to LPAC. I would urge people to do whatever they have to do to front load that and give
Absolutely.
The maximum now
Well, let me give a number where people can call. The LaRouche PAC is 800-929-7566. 800, it's toll-free, 800-929-7566. And the webcast will be this Thursday, 1 p.m., Thursday, January 17th at 1 p.m. And you can get your friends to listen to this program today with Deborah Freeman, Michael Steger, and Megan Roulard by going on to LaRouchePub.com, where you can pick up the archives and of the LaRouche Show every week. So that's all our time. Debbie, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll see you next week on the LaRouche Show.
Great. It was my pleasure.